This is a reading of the autobiography of Rudolf Steiner, entitled Chapters in the Course of My Life, 1861 to 1907. Part 1, Seeds of Awakening, Wiener Neustadt to Vienna, 1861 to 1890. Chapter 1. In public discussions on anthroposophy, the science of spirit that I practice, people have recently expressed views and opinions about the course of my life. From what has been said, people have rushed to judge the cause of what are considered to be changes in my spiritual development. Because of this, friends have suggested that I write something about my life. I must admit that I am not very inclined to do this. I have always tried to fit what I had to say or felt obliged to do to what the facts demanded, and not to anything personal. Indeed, it has always been my opinion that in many areas of human activity, the personal element gives the most valuable coloring, but it seems to me that it should be known through one's speech and actions, and not by looking at one's own personality. What such self-observation can produce is a matter we must each settle for ourselves. Nevertheless, I have decided to write this account of my life for the following reasons. I feel obligated to offer an objective description of my spiritual path. I wish to correct numerous mistaken ideas about my personal relationship to what I have advanced in anthroposophy, and the urgent request of friends seems justified under the circumstances. My parents came from Lower Austria. My father was born in Graz, a small village in Waldviertel in Lower Austria. My mother came from Horn, a city in the same area. My father spent his childhood and youth in close contact with the Premonstrantensian monastery in Graz. He always recalled this period of his life with great pleasure. He liked to tell of how he served in the monastery and was taught by the monks. Later he became a gamekeeper in the service of Count Hoyos. This family owned property in Horn, where my father met my mother. He kept his post as gamekeeper and became a telegraph operator employed by the Southern Austrian Railroad. Initially, he was assigned to a small railroad station in South Styria. Later, he was transferred to Kraljevec, on the border between Hungary and Croatia. At this time, he married my mother. Her maiden name was Bli, and she came from an old family in Horn. I was born on February 27, 1861, in Kraljevec. Thus it is that my birthplace was far from the area of my family's origin. My father and mother were both true children of the glorious Lower Austrian forest district north of the Danube. The railroad appeared rather late in this area. Even today, 1924, Graz has not yet been influenced by it. My parents loved the memories of their native region. When they spoke of it, one felt that although destiny caused them to spend the most of their lives far from that district, their souls had never left it. When my father eventually retired after a busy life, they immediately returned to Horn. My father had an extremely kind disposition, but occasionally his temperament flared up passionately, especially when he was young. He was not terribly interested in his work for the railroad and considered it simply as a duty. When I was a boy, he occasionally had to be on duty continually for 3 days and nights, and then be relieved for 24 hours. Life for him had no bright colors, but was all dull and gray. He happily busied himself by following political conditions. My mother had to devote herself to domestic matters, since we had few worldly goods. She lovingly cared for her children and looked after the little household, and this filled her days. When I was 18 months old, my father was transferred to Mödling, near Vienna, and we stayed there for 6 months. My father was later placed in charge of the small southern railroad station in Potschach in Lower Austria, near the Styrian border. I lived there between my second and eighth years. A wonderful landscape surrounded me in my childhood, and the view stretched to the mountains between Lower Austria and Styria, Schneeberg, Wechsel, Raxalp and Semmering. The sun's rays were caught on the bare rocky peak of the Schneeberg and reflected down to the little railroad station. Their message was the first morning greeting on beautiful summer days. In contrast, the gray back of Wechsel presented an earnest mood. The mountains rose gently from the greenness of a smiling, friendly landscape. One had the majestic peaks in the distance and the sweet charm of nature in the immediate surroundings. At the small station, everyone was busy operating the railroad. In those days, the trains in this region ran only at long intervals. When they had the time, it was customary for people of the village to gather at the station to bring some variety into their somewhat monotonous lives. The schoolmaster, the priest, the accountant from the manor, and often the mayor would all be there. I believe it was significant for my life that I spent my childhood in such an environment. My interest was drawn strongly toward the mechanical quality in that existence, and I realized that this interest always tended to obscure the deep bond of sympathy that my young heart felt with that charming and majestic natural world into which the train, always subject to the mechanical, disappeared in the distance. This is all mingled with my impression of a very unusual personality, the priest from St. Valentin. That village is about a 45-minute walk from Potchak, and the priest liked to visit my parents. Our home became the daily goal of his walks, and he always stayed for some time. He was a liberal type of Catholic clergy, tolerant and genial. Robust, broad-shouldered, and witty, he liked to joke and hear people laugh. And what he said often made one laugh some time after he had gone. He was also practical and could give good, sensible advice. One such piece of advice had a lasting effect in my family. The railroad track in Potchak was flanked by acacia trees, and once, when we were walking on the narrow footpath under these trees, he said, "What beautiful acacia blossoms!" Instantly he swung himself up into a tree and picked a great mass of blossoms. Then, spreading out his huge red handkerchief, he was passionately fond of snuff, he carefully wrapped up his haul and put the bundle under his arm. He said, "You are lucky to have so many acacias." Surprised, my father asked, "Well, what good are they?" "My goodness," said the priest, "don't you realize that acacia blossoms can be baked just like elder flowers? But they taste much better and have a more delicate flavor." After that, whenever the opportunity arose, we often enjoyed baked acacia blossoms. In Potchak, my parents also bore a daughter and another son. There were no further additions to the family. End of chapter 1. Chapter 2. I had a strange habit as a very young child. From the moment I was able to feed myself, it was necessary to watch me very closely. I was convinced that a plate or cup was intended for only one use. After each meal, if not watched, I would smash the cup or plate by throwing it under the table. If my mother appeared, I would call out, "Mother, I am finished now." It was not because I was inclined to be destructive. I treated my toys with painstaking care, keeping them in good condition and making them last. There were particular toys that captivated me, which I still consider especially good. These were illustrated books with figures that were moved by pulling strings from below. Little stories that accompanied the pictures came to life as one pulled the strings. I spent many hours with my sister over these picture books. I spontaneously learned the first elements of reading from them. My father was eager that I learn to read and write at an early age. When I reached the required school age, I was sent to the village school, whose headmaster was an old man to whom teaching was a burden, and it was also a burden for me to be taught by him. In fact, I believed he could teach me nothing. He, his wife, and their small son frequently came to our house. My opinion at the time was that the son was a rascal. I firmly believed that nothing could be learned from anyone with such a scamp of a son. Moreover, one day something very bad happened. This rascal, who was also a pupil at the school, played a prank by dipping a chip of wood in all the inkwells and making circles of ink blotches around them. By the time his father discovered this, most of the pupils had gone home, but his son, a couple of other boys, and I were still there. The teacher was beside himself and gave us a terrible bawling out. I was convinced that he would have roared, except that he was always hoarse. Despite his anger, our behavior gave him a notion of the culprit's identity. But then something else happened. The teacher's family lived next to the schoolroom, and hearing the commotion, his wife came in, gesturing wildly. Her eyes blazed, and she was thoroughly convinced that her little son would not have done such a thing. She accused me, and I ran. My father became furious when I told him. The next time that the teacher and his family came to our home, my father announced in no uncertain terms that our friendship was finished, exclaiming, "My boy will not be allowed to set foot in your school again." My father then took over my instruction himself. After that, I sat for hours next to him in his office, and I had to write and read while he attended to his duties and taught me. My father could not interest me in what I was supposed to learn through instruction, but I was very interested in what he wrote. I wanted to imitate everything he did, and in this way I learned much. I was unable to relate to what he asked of me for my education, but in a childlike way I grew into everything practical. All that was related to running the railroad stirred my interest. However, the laws of nature and their simpler manifestations especially drew my interest. When I practiced writing, it was because I had to do it, and I would do it as fast as possible in order to quickly fill the page. Then I could take the sand my father used and sprinkle it over the written page. I was interested in watching how quickly the sand dried the ink and observing the resulting mixture. I continually tested the letters with my fingers to see which ones were dry. My curiosity was such that I usually tested the letters too soon. Consequently, the appearance of my written exercises did not please my father at all. Nevertheless, he was good-natured, and my only punishment was that he often called me a confirmed smudger. And I gained other knowledge from my writing lessons. The quill itself interested me far more than the forms of my letters. By forcing my father's penknife into the slit and the quill, I could make physiological studies of the elasticity of quill substance. I closed the slit, but the beauty of my handwriting suffered greatly as a result. My eagerness to investigate natural processes led me into a situation that on the one hand enabled me to recognize the way things are related, on the other brought me up against the limits of knowledge. There was a mill about 3 minutes' walk from our house. The miller and his wife were godparents of my sister and brother. We were always welcome in the mill, and I could often be found there. I, quote-unquote, studied the milling industry with great enthusiasm, and this was where I penetrated the, quote, inner core of nature, unquote. Even closer to our home was a textile factory. The raw materials for this factory would arrive at the station, and afterward the finished products left from the station. Consequently, I was able to participate in whatever disappeared into the factory and emerged from it. But we were not allowed even a glimpse into the inner core of the factory itself. That was something I never accomplished, and I came up against the, quote-unquote, limits of knowledge. And I was very eager to transcend those limits. The factory manager came to see my father on business almost every day. To me, that man was a riddle. He cast a veil of mystery over the secrets of the factory's inner core. He was covered with white fuzz, and there was something fixed about his gaze because of his work with machines. He was hoarse, and his speech was mechanical. Quote, "What is the connection between this man, and what is hidden within those walls?" Unquote. I found no answer to this question, but I never asked anyone about the mystery. As a child, it was my opinion that it was useless to ask about something one could not see. Thus I lived between the friendly mill and the unfriendly textile factory. Once an extremely shattering event occurred at the railroad station. A freight train was roaring in, and my father saw it coming. One of its rear cars was on fire, and the train crew was completely unaware of it. The train had reached our station in flames. The whole incident left a deep impression on me. The fire had started in a car carrying some highly flammable material. For a long time I asked myself how this could happen. As in other cases, the explanations of those around me failed to satisfy me. I had countless questions, but they remained unanswered. Thus I reached my 8th year. The end of chapter 2. Chapter 3. When I was 7 years old, we moved to Neudörfel, a small Hungarian village. Neudörfel is directly in the lower Austrian border, formed by the Lethe River. The station where my father was now in charge stood at one end of the village. It took 30 minutes to walk to the river at the border and another 30 minutes to reach Wiener Neustadt. The Alps, which at Potschach had been very close, were seen in the distance from here. Yet they stood in the background as reminders when we looked toward the lower mountains, which could be reached quickly from our new home. Moderate heights with beautiful woodlands limited the view in one direction. In the other, the gaze swept over a level land of fields and forests toward Hungary. One mountain, which could be climbed in about 45 minutes, was particularly dear to me. At the top was a chapel containing an image of Saint Rosalie. This chapel was the end of a walk I often took with my family. Later on, I loved to go there by myself. Another pleasure one could derive in the proper season from those walks was to return richly laden with the gifts of nature. One could find blackberries, raspberries, and strawberries in the woods. After a couple of hours of berry picking, it was very satisfying to bring home a delicious contribution to the family's evening meal, which otherwise consisted of a piece of bread and butter, or bread and cheese. Those woods were communal property, and rambling there brought other pleasures as well. Villagers collected their wood supply from the forests. Those who were poor collected it themselves, and the well-to-do had their servants collect it. There one came to know all the people of the village, and they were mostly of a kind and cheerful disposition. When they saw Steiner Rudolf come along, they always had time to talk. "Well, do you feel like a bit of a walk again, Steiner Rudolf?" They would begin this way and go on to talk about all kinds of things. They never stopped to consider that they were talking to a child. They themselves were essentially children as well, even after 60 years. Consequently, I learned about almost everything that happened in the village. Sauerbrunn is a 30-minute walk along a footpath from Neudörfel. There is a spring containing carbonated water with iron in Sauerbrunn. The path runs along the railroad and partly through beautiful woods. During school holidays, I walk there very early in the morning every day, laden with a blutzer, a clay water container. Mine carried about 3 or 4 liters. There was no cost to fill it at the spring. At noon, the family would enjoy delicious, sparkling water. Toward Wiener Neustadt and farther toward Styria, the mountains fall away into level country. The Lather River winds its way through there. There was a monastery of the Order of the Most Holy Redeemer on the slope of the mountains. I often met the monks on my walks. I still remember how glad it would have made me if they had spoken to me, but they never did. As a result, those meetings always left me with a somewhat vague but solemn impression that remained for some time. I was in my 9th year when I became convinced that there were very important matters connected with the tasks of those monks, and that I had to learn what they were. Again, I had innumerable questions that remained unanswered. Indeed, questions about all kinds of matters made me very lonely as a boy. Pitten and Frohsdorf, 2 castles on the foothills of the Alps, were within sight. In those days, Count Schamberg lived in Frohsdorf. At the beginning of the 1870s, he claimed the throne of France as Henry V. I was deeply impressed by what I saw of the life of Frohsdorf Castle. The Count with his retinue often left by train from the station at Neudörfel. Everything about those people caught my attention. One man of the retinue made an especially deep impression on me. He had only one ear. The other had been cut off completely, and he kept the hair over it braided. Thus I learned what a duel is, since it was in a duel that he lost his ear. Also in relation to Frohsdorf, an aspect of social life was revealed to me. I was often privileged to watch as the assistant teacher at Neudörfel worked in his small private room, where he prepared innumerable appeals to Count Schamberg on behalf of the poor of the village and the surrounding area. Every appeal was responded to with a donation of 1 gulden, out of which the teacher would keep 6 kreutzer for his trouble. He needed that income, since his work brought him a salary of only 58 gulden a year. Also, he had morning coffee and lunch with the schoolmaster, and gave extra lessons to about 10 children, including myself, for which he received 1 gulden a month. I owe a great deal to that assistant teacher, but not because I gained much from his lessons in class. In this respect, matters were about the same as in Potschach. As soon as we moved to Neudörfel, I was sent to school. That school had 1 classroom where 5 classes of boys and girls were taught simultaneously. When the boys in any row had to copy the story of King Arpad, the very young children stood at the blackboard on which I or you was drawn for them. One could only brood dully and let one's hand do the copying almost mechanically. The assistant teacher had to do almost all the teaching. The schoolmaster seldom appeared at the school, since he was also the village notary. It was said that this occupation kept him so busy that he never had time to teach. Despite all this, I did learn to read well relatively early, and this enabled the assistant teacher to bring into my life something that became a guiding principle for me. Soon after I entered the school at Neudörfel, I discovered a geometry book in his room. Since I was on very good terms with the teacher, I was allowed to borrow the book to study privately. I plunged into it with enthusiasm, and for weeks my soul was completely filled with the congruence, the similarity of triangles, quadrilaterals, and polygons. I racked my brains over the question of where parallel lines actually intersect. The theorem of Pythagoras fascinated me. I derived a deep feeling of contentment from the fact that one could live with the soul in building forms that are seen wholly inwardly, independent of the outer senses. I found consolation for my mood caused by so many unanswered questions. The ability to grasp something purely through the spirit brought me an inner joy. I realized that I first knew happiness through geometry. The end of chapter 3. Chapter 4. I must acknowledge that my relationship to geometry was the beginning of a view that took shape gradually within me. During childhood it lived in me more or less unconsciously. By my 20th year it had assumed a definite, fully conscious form. I would have said that the objects and events seen by the senses exist in space, the space outside the human being. But a kind of soul space exists within as the setting for spiritual beings and events. I could not see anything in thoughts that was like pictures we form of things. Rather, they were revelations of a spiritual world on the stage of the soul. To me, geometry seemed to be a knowledge that we ourselves produce, but its significance is completely independent of us. Of course, as a child, I could not have expressed this to myself clearly, but I felt that knowledge of the spiritual world must in fact be carried within the soul, just as geometry is. The spiritual world's reality was as certain to me as the physical world's reality, but I needed a justification for this assumption. I wanted to prove to myself that experiencing the spiritual world is no more an illusion than experiencing the sensory world. In regard to geometry, I could say that one may know something that the soul experiences solely through its own power. I found in this feeling the justification for speaking of the spiritual world I experienced, just as I spoke of the physical. And I did speak of it that way. I had two mental images that, although still undefined, played an important role in my inner life, even before my 8th year. I differentiated between things and beings that are visible and things that are invisible. I relate these things truthfully, but those who want evidence to justify calling anthroposophy fantastic will perhaps conclude that since I was inclined to the fantastic even as a child, it is no surprise that I later evolved a fantastic worldview. But I know that when I later described the spiritual world, I did it as required by the facts themselves, and not according to personal inclinations. Thus I can look back objectively to my childhood and to my childish and awkward way of using geometry to justify my talk of an invisible world. I must add, however, that I loved living in that world. I would have experienced the sensory world as a surrounding spiritual darkness if it had not received light from that other world. Through his geometry book, that assistant teacher at Neudörfel provided me with a confirmation of the spiritual world I needed then. And I must thank him for other things. He brought me art. He played the piano and the violin. He also drew a lot. Those things strongly drew me to him, and I was with him as much as possible. He particularly liked to draw. In my 9th year, he had me draw with charcoal, and I would copy pictures in this way under his guidance. For example, I spent a long time copying a portrait of Count Szekenyi. I was also able to listen to the deeply impressive music of the Hungarian gypsies, sometimes in Neudörfel, but more often in neighboring Sauerbrunn. All of this played a role in my childhood, which was passed in the immediate vicinity of the church and cemetery. The railroad station at Neudörfel is a short distance from the church, with the cemetery between. If one walked along the cemetery and a little farther, one came to the village itself. The village consisted of two rows of houses. One row began with the school, the other with the rectory. A small brook flowed between the rows of houses, and on both sides of the brook magnificent nut trees grew. In relation to these nut trees, a kind of hierarchical order grew up among the school children. As the nuts began to ripen, boys and girls bombarded the trees with stones, and in this way established a store of nuts for the winter. During the autumn, children talked of little but their supply of nuts. Whoever collected the most became the most respected. And thus down it went, step by step, to me, the last, a stranger in the village, who had no right to partake in this hierarchical order. The big farmers lived in the main row of houses of the village. At right angles to these, near the rectory, was a row of about 20 houses occupied by village residents of moderate means, and there was a group of thatched houses owned by the small cottagers next to the gardens of the railroad station. Those were our immediate neighbors. The roads from the village led to fields and vineyards owned by people of the village. Every year, along with the small cottagers, I participated in gathering grapes, and once in a village wedding. After the assistant teacher, of those connected with the school, I loved the priest most. He came regularly, twice a week, to give religious instruction. He also came frequently to inspect the school. His image is engraved in my soul. Throughout my life he has repeatedly arisen in my memory. He was by far the most significant personality I met before my 10th or 11th year. He was an energetic Hungarian patriot and took a vigorous part in the Magyarizing of the Hungarian territory taking place at the time. He expressed his convictions in articles written in Hungarian. I was familiar with those articles because the assistant teacher had to make clear copies of them and, despite my youth, always discussed their content with me. The priest was also an energetic worker for the church. One of his sermons impressed this upon me in a striking way. In Neudörfel there was a lodge of Freemasons. It was veiled in mystery to the villagers, who told the most peculiar tales about it. The leader of the lodge was the director of a match factory at one end of the village. Aside from him, among the locals, only another factory manager and a clothing merchant took an active part in the lodge. Otherwise it seemed significant only because strangers occasionally arrived from afar who appeared very eerie to the villagers. Furthermore, the clothing merchant was a strange person who always walked with his head bowed as if lost in thought. He was called, quote, the pretender, unquote, and owing to his peculiar manner it was not possible, nor was it one inclined, to approach him. His house was the meeting place for the lodge of Freemasons. I could not develop a relationship to this lodge. Because of the behavior of the people around me toward it, I had to give up asking questions again. Moreover, I was repelled by the distasteful way the owner of the match factory spoke of the church. Nevertheless, one Sunday the priest gave an energetic sermon, as usual, on the significance of true morality for human life. He spoke of the enemies of truth in images taken from the lodge. He ended his address by saying, quote, beloved Christians, realize who the enemies of the truth are, for example, a Freemason or a Jew, unquote. To the villagers, the factory owner and the clothier were thus marked by an authority. What impressed me in particular was the power of will with which this was said. I am also indebted to that priest for something that contributed to my later spiritual orientation. He left a profound impression on me one day, when he came to the school and gathered round him in the teacher's little room the more mature pupils, among whom he included me. He unrolled a drawing he had made, from which he explained Copernican astronomy to us. He spoke in a particularly vivid way about the Earth's revolution around the sun, its rotation and inclination on its axis, and about summer and winter and the climatic zones of Earth. I was completely absorbed, and spent days making copies of his drawings. Later I had another special lesson from the parson concerning sun and moon eclipses, and after that all my desire for knowledge turned to this subject. The end of chapter 4. Chapter 5. At the time I was about 10 years old and could not spell correctly or write grammatically. The proximity of the church and surrounding cemetery was profoundly significant for my life as a boy. Everything that happened at the village school was connected with the church. This was not due only to the prevailing social and state circumstances peculiar to that time and region. It was mainly because of the priest's significant personality. The assistant teacher was the church organist and vestment custodian, and he assisted the minister with everything connected with the cult. As schoolboys, we acted as servers and choir members at Mass. Let me read that again. As schoolboys, we acted as servers and choir members at Mass, memorial services for the dead, and funerals. My youthful soul gladly lived in the ceremonious nature of the Latin language and the cult. Until my 10th year, I intensively took part in serving in the church, and this often enabled me to be in the company of the priest whom I revered so deeply. My relationship with the church was not encouraged at home. My father was uninterested in the church. He was a freethinker at that time and never attended the church to which I had such a close bond. Yet he, too, had been devoted to the church and had served it in his childhood and youth. This changed again when he returned to Horn, his native region, as an elderly pensioner. He became pious again. But by that time I had long ago lost the connection with my parents' home. My most vivid memory of my childhood in Neudörfel is of the cult and the solemn liturgical music and how it caused the questions of existence to arise with moving power before my spirit. The priest's Bible instruction and the catechism had much less effect on my inner life than did his actions as celebrant of the ritual in mediating between the sensory and supersensory worlds. From the very beginning, this was never a mere form to me, but was a profound inner experience. And this was even more so, since it made me a stranger in my own home. Nevertheless, my home environment did not diminish the spiritual richness I received through the ritual. I lived in my environment without participating in it. I saw it, but I actually thought, contemplated, and sensed continually in relation to that other world. Nevertheless, I can say that I was not a dreamer in any sense, but came to terms with every practical activity related as a matter of course to daily life. My father's political arguments also contrasted sharply with the world I inwardly experienced. He and another employee took turns on duty. That man lived at another railroad station, which he helped to run. He came to Neudörfel every 2 or 3 days. In the evenings, during the hours of relaxation, he and my father spoke of politics. They would sit beside the station at the table under 2 huge, wonderful linden trees. There the whole family and the other employee gathered. My mother would knit or crochet while my brother and sister romped about. I sat often at the table and listened to the 2 men's endless political discussions. I was never interested in what they were saying, but more in the form their conversation took. They always disagreed if one said, quote, yes, unquote, the other said no. All this was accompanied with signs of vehemence, even passion, but also with the amiability that was my father's basic nature. A small circle often gathered on such occasions, frequently including local dignitaries and occasionally a physician from Wiener Neustadt, who treated many patients in the area, since there was no resident physician at that time. He came from Wiener Neustadt to Neudörfel on foot. After he had seen his patients, he came to the station to wait for the return train. My family considered the man odd, as in fact most people did who knew him. He was not inclined to talk about his medical profession, but he loved to talk about German literature. He was the first to speak to me of Lessing, Goethe, and Schiller, since such topics were never discussed at home. One knew nothing of them, nor were they mentioned at the village school. The emphasis there was entirely related to Hungarian history. Neither the priest nor the assistant teacher had any interest in the great names of German literature. Thus the physician from Wiener Neustadt opened a whole new world before me. He liked to talk to me. Often, after he had rested a while under the linden trees, he would take me aside and he would pace back and forth near the station while he talked about German literature, not pedantically, but full of enthusiasm. In those discussions he developed all kinds of ideas concerning the beautiful and the ugly. Another memory I have always deeply cherished is of the tall, slender doctor with a vigorous step who always carried an umbrella in his right hand so that it dangled next to his body at one side, while on his other side I, a boy of 10, was completely absorbed in what he was saying. Along with all these things, I was also very interested in the operation of the railroad. I learned the laws of electricity by watching the station telegraph. Also as a child I learned to send telegrams. As for language, I grew up with the German dialect spoken in the eastern section of Lower Austria. Mostly this was also spoken then in the regions of Hungary that bordered Lower Austria. My relationship to reading was completely different from my relationship to writing. As a boy, I passed over the words when reading and went straight to the meaning, that is, to the percepts, concepts, or ideas behind the words. Consequently, my reading did nothing to develop my sense for spelling and grammar. On the other hand, when writing, I had the urge to hold fast to the words, images, and sounds, exactly as I typically heard them spoken in the dialect. But because of this, it was only with great difficulty that I learned to write the literary language, whereas I found reading easy from the beginning. Under these influences, I reached the age when my father had to decide whether to send me to the Gymnasium for classical studies or to the Realschule for technical training in Wiener Neustadt. During this time, I often heard him discussing my future between the political arguments. My father was given various advice, but I knew even then that he simply liked to hear what others had to say, but acted according to his own determination. The end of chapter 5. Chapter 6. My father intended to prepare me in a suitable way for a position with the railroad. This influenced his decision about whether to send me to the Gymnasium or the Realschule. He finally decided I should be a railroad engineer. Thus he chose the Realschule. However, before transferring me from the village school at Neudörfel to a school in neighboring Wiener Neustadt, it had to be determined whether I was, in fact, ready for either kind of school. Consequently, I was taken to the middle school for my entrance examination. All these things, done for the benefit of my future, did not interest me very much. At that age, my future position was a matter of indifference to me, as was the matter of whether I should go to the middle school, the Realschule, or the Gymnasium. The world around me and the matters I had thought about filled me with indefinite but burning questions about life and the world. I wanted to learn something just to be able to answer those questions. I had little concern about what type of school would bring this about. I very successfully passed the entrance examination in the middle school. All the drawings I had done for the assistant teacher had been sent with me, and they impressed the teachers who examined me, so that gaps in my knowledge were overlooked. I left with a brilliant testimonial. This brought great joy to my parents, as well as the assistant teacher, priest, and the many dignitaries of Neudörfel. They all rejoiced in my success. To many of them, this proved that the Neudörfel school could, quote, teach a thing or two, unquote. This gave my father the idea that, since I was so far advanced, it would be unnecessary for me to spend a preliminary year in the middle school. I could go straight to the Realschule. Thus, a few days later, I had to take an entrance examination to that school. Things there did not go as well. Nevertheless, I was admitted. This was in October, 1872. Now I had to travel from Neudörfel to Wiener Neustadt every day. In the morning, I could go by train. But in the evening, I had to walk back, since there was no train at that time. Neudörfel was in Hungary, Wiener Neustadt in Lower Austria. Consequently, I went every day from Transleithania to Cisleithania, the official names for the Hungarian and Austrian districts. During midday, I remained in Wiener Neustadt. One day I became acquainted with a lady while she waited for a train at the Neudörfel station. She heard that I was going to school in Wiener Neustadt. My parents had spoken to her of their concern about where I could spend noontime while attending school. She said she would be happy to give me lunch at her house free of charge, and that I could come whenever I needed to. During summer, the footpath from Wiener Neustadt to Neudörfel is very beautiful, but in winter it was often very difficult. After leaving town, it was a half-hour walk to the village along a field path, which was not cleared of snow. I often had to wade through snow up to my knees and would arrive home looking like a snowman. I could not find an inner relationship with city life as I did with life in the country. I could not imagine how life must be in those rows of houses so jammed together. Nevertheless, I would stand for a long time before the bookshops in Wiener Neustadt. Also, at first, I could not become interested in what was taught at the school and the work assigned. I had great difficulty keeping up with the other students in the first two classes. Things did not go better until the second half of the second year. Only then did I become a good student. I had a deeply felt need. I longed for persons whom I could revere and whose example I could follow. No such persons were among my teachers in the first two grades. But again, something that happened in school influenced me deeply. The headmaster had written an article which was published in the annual report at the end of the school year. It was titled, quote, "The Force of Attraction Considered as an Effect of Motion," unquote. As a child of 11, initially I understood practically nothing of its meaning. It began immediately with higher mathematics, yet from single sentences I did glean some meaning. I began to see a connection between that article and what I had learned from the priest about the structure of the universe. In the article, the headmaster referred to his book, titled The General Motion of Matter as the Fundamental Cause of All Physical Phenomena. I saved until I could buy it. It became like a kind of ideal to learn as quickly as possible everything that could help me understand the article and the book. They addressed the following. The headmaster's idea was that it is an unjustified mystical hypothesis that, quote-unquote, forces go out from matter into the distance. He tried to explain the attraction, in quotes, between heavenly bodies and between molecules and atoms without such forces. He said that between any two bodies are many smaller bodies, all in motion. The smaller bodies moving back and forth impinge upon the larger ones, and these larger bodies are impinged upon everywhere, even on those sides turned away from one another. These impingements are more numerous than those in the space between the two bodies. Hence they approach one another. Consequently, he did not consider attraction a special force, but merely an effect of motion. On the first page of the book, I found two assertions. One, space and motion within it have existed for a long time. Two, space and time are continuously homogeneous magnitudes. Matter, on the other hand, consists of separate small particles or atoms. The author wanted to explain all physical and chemical processes in nature on the basis of the motion, arising as described, between the smaller and the larger parts of matter. I did not feel drawn to this view, nor did I see any reason to agree with it. But I felt it would be important for me to understand what was presented in this way. I did everything to understand it. Whenever I had a chance to lay my hands on mathematics and physics books, I did so. It went very slowly. I repeatedly began reading the article in the book. Each time, it went a little better. Now something else happened. In my third year, I did get a teacher who really fulfilled my ideal. He was a person whom I could emulate. He taught arithmetic, geometry, and physics, and his teaching was extraordinarily ordered and lucid. He built up everything from the very foundation, and with such clarity that to follow him was tremendously beneficial for one's thinking. There was another article in an annual report, and an annual school report, by him. It addressed the theory of probabilities and calculation in life insurance. I failed to understand much of this one as well, but busied myself with it all the same. I was soon able to comprehend the meaning of the theory of probabilities. More important to me, however, was the exactness with which this beloved teacher approached his material, which gave me a model for my own mathematical thinking. This led to a wonderful relationship between that teacher and me. It was a blessing to have this man as my teacher in both mathematics and physics throughout my years in the Realschule. What he taught gradually helped me toward a better understanding of the enigma presented to me by the headmaster's writings. It took a much longer time before I came to a closer relationship with another teacher. He taught geometric drawing in the lower classes and descriptive geometry in the upper. He taught even at the second class level. However, it wasn't until the third year that I learned to appreciate his lessons. His geometric drawings were magnificent. His lessons, too, were exemplary, clear, and systematic. Because of him, it became my favorite occupation to draw with a compass, ruler, and triangle. Through all that, I absorbed from the headmaster, the teacher of mathematics and physics, and this teacher of geometric drawings, puzzling questions related to natural phenomena arose in me, though in a boyish way. I felt that I had to grapple with the phenomena of the sensory world in order to gain a perspective of the spiritual world that was naturally visible before me. I was convinced that one could come to terms with the spiritual world through the soul, as long as thinking assumes a form capable of grasping the true nature of physical phenomena. These feelings accompanied me during my third and fourth years at the Realschule. Everything I learned, I mobilized in order to come closer to this goal. Then, one day, I passed a bookstore. In the window was Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, in Reclam's edition. I did everything I could to buy this book as soon as possible. The end of chapter 6.